Okay, thank you very much. And yes, as Andrea was introducing before, I will talk about the far infrared line emission from the ISM of a redshift galaxies. But before going into the details of the modeling that I performed in the last few years regarding the prediction of the far infrared line emission from the interstellar medium of the first galaxy that form after at the end of the epoch of reionization, essentially, I just want to explain a bit the motivation behind the world, so why we are interested in far infrared line emission, and why they are very important probes of the interstellar medium, and why now we are in a golden era for this kind of study, essentially because of ALMA, as I think all of you already know. So essentially, let's consider a patch of the ISM. The ISM is a rather complex environment, so we have many different phases that compose the interstellar medium. We have ionized gas around the star-forming regions, and we have a diffuse medium that is neutral, and that is found to be essentially in two different phases. One is cold and the other is warm. And these two phases are in pressure equilibrium, essentially. So if we take into account of the standard theory for this for the equilibrium of the neutral ISM, and you take into account of the balance between heating and cooling processes, essentially you end up with this equilibrium curve, and there is a range of pressure in which you can find two different and distinct phases, one at lower densities, which is the warm neutral medium, and the other one is the cold neutral medium. And in the cold neutral medium, possibly you can also find molecular clouds embedded, and then within the molecular clouds, you can eventually form stars and start again with all these pictures. So it's a complex, environment, the ISM. Essentially, the heating processes are led by the photoelectric effect on dust grains, which is caused by the Faruvi photons, which penetrate in the neutral medium. And the cooling is led by the fine structure line emission from metals, which are in the far infrared. So any probe of the far infrared lines is very important because you can constrain the properties of the gas, essentially. So if you go in much deeper details on the structure of the gas impinged by far UV radiation, you end up with the picture that Paola described 2 days ago. So you have a photodissociation region. You have a part of the gas slab that is essentially neutral and is in which the hydrogen is essentially neutral. You have the carbon that is that is ionized. You have the neutral oxygen and the emission from the 158 micron from the single ionized carbon is the leading contribution for the cooling. So any detection of the C plus line is important to constrain the properties of the neutral gas, essentially. Then if you go farther and deeper in the gas lab, you have the molecular hydrogen and CO rotational lines become the very important to trace this part. And also the CO rotational lines are essentially in the far infrared or submillimeter. So I hope that after this brief introduction, you can understand why we are so interested in studying and modeling these lines. And with far infrared lines, you can infer the gas density, the relative abundance of different gas phases, some information regarding the flux impinging the cloud. You can also constrain some way the metallicity. So it's really useful to observe this line. And moreover, they are not affected by dust extinction. So this that helps a lot.
Yeah, how many lines you actually need to go and constrain all of these things?
The more the better, I would say. But I mean, for instance, the C plus is the most luminous, but it's the most difficult to be interpreted because it arises from essentially from here, and also from the dense photodissociation region around the molecular clouds. So you don't know you need to model very well the relative contribution of the different gas phases. For instance, if you observe the oxygen tree, that probes essentially this part, so the outer layer, the H2 region essentially. And you observe the oxygen one, you can have information regarding the relative fraction of ionized gas versus neutral gas, but neutral gas that is very dense because the oxygen is traced very dense gas, so has a higher critical density with respect to C+. But I mean, the more the better. You have also nitrogen lines. Yes, the answer is I would say the better thing to do is to use maybe the oxygen 3, the carbon plus, and the oxygen 1, I would say. But and, okay, yes. Yes. Yes, because the oxygen, because it's also the same element. For the metallicity, you need to use different elements so that you can infer information about this quantity. So the observation of the C+ and other far infrared lines started in the 90s in the Milky Way. Then with Herschel, we moved to the local universe and at slightly higher redshift. Then with the plateau de Bure interferometer, so with facilities in the submillimeter, you can pinpoint lines that arise from very high redshift and fall in the submillimeter band. And then with ALMA now, we have a new window on the first galaxies, but not only the quasars or very powerful and rare sources, but normal star-forming galaxies. So the one that represents the bulk of the population at the end of the reionization epoch. So these are just two examples of detection in the 2015, and these are the C+ contours. Only 8 out of 10 detection in Lemaître galaxy at redshift around 6, and this is another detection at redshift 7.1. So my work is related to the modeling of these lines. So I want to know what we can learn from the observation of these lines, and I want the aim is to predict the line luminosity, the expected spectra, the expected spatial distribution of this emission, and things like that. And so to do that, I work on subgrid modeling, essentially. So starting from cosmological simulation, which allow us to probe a big volume of the universe, we can select specific galaxies out of the simulation, but all the physics on small scales of the ISM need to be in some way implemented also in post-processing, because you don't have the possibility to follow every single process in the cosmological simulation. So I developed a series of subgrid models to predict especially the C+ luminosity, but also other far infrared lines. Given that the C+ is the most luminous, I focus on the neutral gas, essentially, because the C+ essentially traces the neutral gas, even though there is a small fraction from ionized gas. But then with my models, I predict far infrared line luminosity and also provide prediction for the observing times and things like that. So the first work in 2013 was focused on a single galaxy extracted from a cosmological simulation at redshift 6.6. So we had this cosmological simulation, then we select the most massive halo at that redshift. This is a snapshot of the simulation. And then on the zoom simulation, we perform all the radiative transfer. So it's a simulation with the radiative transfer so that we know the ionization state of the gas, essentially, at the end of the radiative transfer. And we...
How do you know where the sources are?
Sorry?
How do you know where the ionizing sources are?
Because the galaxy was constructed so that the distribution of the stars reproduce a specific Lyman alpha emitter star redshift 6.6, so in ICO, which is the most luminous. So this is the reason why we select the most massive halo. And so the stars, and I'll show you in a few slides, are located essentially at the center and reproduce the observed distribution of stars in this specific object. Of course, any galaxy has its own distribution, but this is the starting point for us. So then the problem is that, as I explained before, the C+ trace especially the cold and warm neutral medium and the dense gas in PDRs.
So how sure, I mean, is this statement based on the models, or do you think the M2 comparisons rule out ionized contributions? So you keep dismissing the prospect of C plus mixed with the ionized phase. I'm wondering what the...
Well, actually, we also made some calculation regarding that. Unfortunately, I don't have the slide here. But we found that the contribution, at least in this for this simulation, was less than, I'd say, 10%. And also, there are also claims in local dwarf galaxies, so low metallicity galaxies, in which, for instance, the work by Cormier, Susan Madden, and this group claims that at least 40 or 50% of the emission of the C plus come from the cold neutral medium. Then all the other phase, so the dense PDRs and whatever, and the ionized gas are less important for the emission. This is what we found, at least for this kind of object. But what they've done is to implement on top of the simulation all the physics of the thermal equilibrium in neutral gas. So in each cell of the simulation, I computed the density and temperature of the cold and warm neutral medium by taking into account all the cooling and heating processes that I mentioned before. And the result is the following. So this is the gas column density from the simulation, okay, without performing the subgrid calculation for the cold medium and warm medium. And this is the stellar distribution is projected. So the stars are located here, here, and here, essentially, so in the overdense region of the simulation. Then, after searching for the for the cold and warm medium, we end up with these two maps. So this is the warm neutral medium column density map, and this is the cold neutral medium column density map. What we found
resolution here
is 60 parsec. Yes.
So each cell has a single temperature and a single density.
Okay. Each cell. What I took from the hydro simulation before performing the subgrid is the essentially the pressure of each cell. Then at that pressure, knowing the radiation field, essentially the metallicity, the amount of dust, and so on and so forth, I calculate the equilibrium curve. Knowing the pressure, I know the density and temperature of the cold and warm medium, essentially, because
But you know the mean density.
Yes, but then I recompute and in each cell I split essentially the two media according to the equilibrium.
So does that mean that in most of your cells you're not sitting in the two phase regime, you're sitting above?
So yes, this is exactly what I am going to mention, because for instance here in this part, which is, first of all, in the region in which we have stars, I don't have neutral medium, and this is okay. Is something that we can understand very well. But here, for instance, I only found one neutral medium, but not the cold phase, because here the radiation field is quite high, while here, for instance, at the periphery, I have the warm neutral medium and the cold phase embedded in the warm medium. So, this is something that before calculating properly the equilibrium curve, I could not essentially say, because I didn't have the processes that cooled down the gas to.
So are you then finding active star formation in regions that don't have a CMM component?
Possibly this region can lead to new star formation, but this is in post-processing, so at that point, I don't know. Yes, in principle, yes. This.
I'm also confused with how you use, you said you use the staff formation rate and metallicity derived from observation, so you, how does that go into this?
Because, I mean, I have the location of stars here, and I know the star formation rate, so I know the field, because I have the relative transfer. Okay.
But you say you use the one from observations, or you just match your galaxy in the relation you have. Ah, okay, because I understood that you were using that.
No, I match, yes. Okay. So, okay.
Can we really separate the one meter and medium quality and medium by under given density? Can we?
So the
fraction,
you mean which is the density threshold that which defines the cold and warm phase?
No. No, so based on the two phase model, you divided each region into two phases. Right?
Yes.
Separation is unique, or I was wondering if the separation is uniquely determined.
Yes, given the pressure, I mean, and the
equilibrium. Only in regions where there's only one stable phase.
There are regions in which you can find the two phases. Region in which you find only one phase, according to the pressure.
Yeah, so when you have two phases possible, is it degenerate?
Yeah.
All you know is the pressure is totally degenerate.
No, I mean, I would say I know.
So if you go back to your curve, wolf line.
Yes,
curve,
sure.
If you're in a regime where the pressure is such that there are two stable phases.
So kind of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
How do you say, oh, I've got 50% of cold neutral medium.
Okay. So how I defined if it's cold. Okay. Well, according, I put some threshold. So I mean, above 50 or 1050 particle per cubic centimeter is called medium. So if I found only one phase that is in this range of density, I call this phase called neutral medium.
So you are taking into account the density of the cell, not only the pressure.
That's the mean density, right? So if the mean density was one.
If the mean density is one,
then
what? Okay, depends. well, in this particular. For this particular equilibrium curve, this is not a stable phase.
Oh, no.
No, okay, but it's a warm neutral medium. It's warm neutral medium. One particle per cubic centimeter is warm neutral medium.
That's a part of your sub-ripple.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
But the density that you mentioned, the simulations, it's not really meaningful, right? Because you don't include cooling or heating, so.
Yeah, but I use the pressure from the simulation. And then I recompute the density.
But if you actually had the same pressure and you put in cooling and heating, then it would separate into two phases with very different density from what you measure in the simulations.
Yes, and this is exactly the point.
I guess is that the issue is that you have cooling, there is cooling in the simulation, so but the scale that you're resolving is not sufficient to split the two phases, right? Because if you could resolve the cold neutral medium clouds that are cold, in principle you can get them. But you don't see the separation because your cell is too big to allow the resolution of the cold neutral medium clumps.
I understand. I'm just wondering. I'm still worried. Yeah.
No,
there's still some degeneracy.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
No. Yeah, in the sense that in some way you have to post-process something. So.
Any
so this is intrinsic in the mass.
I guess the pressure range is not too big where this problem happens.
Which problem?
That it could be multi-phase.
But there are some multi-phase.
For instance, here, you see here, I don't know if you can see, here I have warm and also cold gas in the same cell.
Mm-hmm.
That's a slice, isn't it?
Yes. It's a column density, so I integrated over.
But they are in the same cell.
Though. No, but yes, I have multi-phase cells.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Can I ask, going back to Adam's question on the star formation and the cold neutral medium interface? So how does the star formation computed in the?
Well, the fact is that the the star formation rate influence the G naught.
Yeah.
The G naught influence the equilibrium curve. So then I will show in the next slide that if you play a bit with the star formation rate, so I assume to scale with other star formation rates, so increase the G naught essentially, the equilibrium curve changes. And also the location, the cells in which you find the cold medium. And the higher is the G naught, the higher is this. So this equilibrium curve goes here. So at the same pressure, you cannot find the cold neutral medium.
Yeah. But I
so
was,
this, in this sense, I relate the star formation rate with the distribution of the world.
How is the star formation rate calculated in the simulation? That was my
That's what we do.
So what we do is reproducing the star forming region of INICO in this specific run. So and performing the relative transfer, assume the star formation rate of INICO that is 30 solar masses per year. Okay, and this is our assumption at the beginning. Then I'll show you that we also modify this assumption to investigate the effect of the star formation rate, so the G naught.
Maybe I'm not explaining myself properly. You have stars already in your galaxy.
Yes.
So what's the star formation relation that you put in the simulation?
Well, you have the location of the star. You know where stars form.
So there's some model is star formation. Yeah. Some density threshold.
Yes.
Density threshold.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry. It's a density threshold.
Yeah. What's the threshold used?
One.
So basically, one neutron medium to form stars.
Yes.
But before, I mean.
Yeah, before you do the separate.
Yeah.
How much does it do the local ionizing sources matter?
A lot, I would say.
Didn't the escape fraction comes in as well?
Well, for the G naught.
I think it's that you're creating H2 regions where you can.
Essentially, the fact is that you have
But I mean, like 60 parsec resolution, right? So like the smallest, you know. Yeah, resolve the escape fraction.
We don't deal with the escape fraction from what, from the galaxy? From the clouds where the stars form, from the clouds.
Well,
this is what is being done is just a survey. This is the location of the star, and then you do the transfer with all the position of the sources in your galaxy. And so you have the H2 region that may be seen somewhere in your picture.
Yeah, yeah.
So within these H2 regions, you don't have any neutral hydrogen, right? So may say that it could be escape fragments. In fact, some region you can escape.
This is in this map, you can see that here, that correspond to here, essentially. You don't have the neutral gas, so it's ionized, the gas there, because you are close to the stars, which is. So now, since I have the density, temperature, and also the velocity field of the gas, because from the hydro, I can compute the spectrum and map of the C+. From the cold and warm neutral medium, and this is the result. So this is the spectrum that we get for solar metallicity, and this is the map. First of all, let's focus on the spectrum. It has a lot of structures. Remind that here the velocity channels is 1 kilometer per second, so it's really narrow with respect to observations that have. I mean, now with ALMA you can have also 5 kilometer per second or things like that. But all this structure is due to the fact that we found all these clumps of cold neutral medium that dominate the emission essentially, because this is the contribution of the warm neutral medium here. And this is the contribution from the cold neutral medium. And I mean, it's 90% of the emission from the diffuse gas.
Sorry, I got confused. So from the maps of cold neutral and warm neutral densities, how did you go from that one to the C+?
Because I know the density,
yeah,
the temperature,
Okay.
And
you just do some conversion there from
the collision. The calculation.
Okay, so you calculated, yes. Okay, because it wasn't clear.
Yes, with collision with neutral, and also I have also the ionized fraction, so collision with electron, but it's neutral. Okay. So I mean, yes. This is not.
And you're saying that if you actually ran the ionized here, that it would make a minor,
yes.
It would make a minor contribution.
Also. Yes, I did that. I don't have the slide here, but I can show you. And
it seems like it must exceed the WNM at least.
Sorry?
It seems like it must at least exceed the WNM.
In some part.
The emissivity of WNM is
in
really
some part,
good.
Yes.
High-density ionized gas, it's pretty good at emitting C+.
In some part, yes. I agree, because, I mean, we found something, it's more centered, mm-hmm. because I want to point out that we found this velocity shift because this clamp, which is dominating the emission, is not centered at the systemic velocity of the galaxy, while the contribution from the ionized, which is not plotted here, is perfectly located here, is low, and is completely centered in at the zero velocity.
But that would also, in principle at least, depend on the density substructure you assume for the ionized gas, right, within the superparsec.
Yes. I didn't go into the details.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's...
No, but yes.
You know, in principle, N2 observations would be very...
Yes, but N2...
No, actually,
it's not plotted yet, sorry, but we also predict the emission from the nitrogen 2, 122 micron, it's centered and but it's very low. So, we don't have observation for the moment to test also the line ratios and things like that. For the moment, I will focus only on C+, because the C+ is the only thing that you can do at redshift 6 for the moment, at least for this kind of object. The line width is, if we define the line width, it's indicated here, the full width at maximum, more or less, and it's 70 kilometers per second. I want to compare with the recent observation, for instance, the two ones that I've shown before. And they found around 100 kilometers per second. So I mean, we are quite consistent with the observation. And I also want to point out that we can also have a slight shift with respect to the zero. So the zero is put by the detection of the Lyman alpha essentially. So you trace the ionized gas, while here you are tracing the neutral gas, which is not completely located in the same part of the galaxy. So you can have, and with ALMA you can appreciate the structure. So it's not only a blob.
If they put the Lyman alpha line on top of this, I mean, you're essentially arguing a small filling fraction in terms of velocity coverage or something because you're clumping, right? So you're saying that only a small fraction of the velocities get populated with bright CNM because you only see a few bright CNM clumps.
Yes.
So if they took the line and alpha line or something like that and overplotted it, I guess what I'm asking is, are these narrow line widths just the dynamical width of the galaxy, or are they legitimately narrower than the Lyman alpha or small coverage compared to Lyman alpha?
I mean, Lyman alpha is broadened by...
So if you pick some other line that would actually trace...
It's narrow.
So this is narrower than the galaxy CNM.
Yes, because you find these clamps, which is not exactly the same clamps that Lucho was mentioning a few days ago. I mean, they are very small. So, you are dominated by the fact that they are small emitting regions. But
this is not the Himiko galaxy, right? Or it is the observation?
No.
But do they correlate in terms of star formation rate and the other properties?
More or less, because the Kappa galaxies are around 60 solar masses per year, around. And
also metallicity, so you can actually use that galaxy as an example? But you said you use metallicity of the...
Here is for this prediction, which is quite high, is for solar metallicity. Then we play also with the metallicity, because it's one of the parameters that we may want to constrain by using far infrared line detection. And yes, again, the map, when you consider only the cold neutral medium, you only find these small blobs at the periphery of the galaxy. And this is something that, at least in one, just one case, that has been observed, because, for instance, this is BDF 3299, that is a galaxy redshift 7.1, and this is the location of the UV continuum rest frame. And this is the C-plus detection, essentially, and is displaced from the...
So, but you could argue the other direction, right? You could say that you're only seeing... Is there a continuum detection of plus?
No.
So, okay, so you would argue that this is not obscuration. It's an it's
no.
offset C-plus instead of missing...
They don't
the
have... they didn't detect the continuum.
Did they see the stellar continuum? So other than the UV, did they see, like...
For this one, yes, it's a Lyman brain.
Okay, so they know where the stars are, and the stars are coincident with the UV.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay, and these are simulations that we perform to interpret this specific object. But apart from the spatial distribution of the C-plus emission, there is another open issue at high redshift, which is really an hot topic now, that is the C-plus deformation rate relation. So, essentially, this is a recent plot by Nunsen, in which we have a collection of high redshift detection and non-detection, and local relation, more precisely. Here you can see the local relation for starburst galaxies and dwarf galaxies, so high redshift zero, and found by Deleuze. So
that's
observation.
Extrapolated, right? There's
a lot
of stuff formation.
Yes, a lot. Okay. Yes. I mean, but I only highlight the plot. So,
okay.
So
the
yes.
No, but
the dwarf galaxies. Yes, it's extrapolated.
Yeah.
So the fact is that according to this relation, for the moment, I mean, you can take either one or the other. So, but you can infer in some way, given if you know the star formation rate, you can infer the expected C-plus luminosity. So people, based on that, ask for ALMA time. And we have two different situations at this point. We have detection. These are the Kappa galaxies, essentially. But we have a bunch of non-detection, which seems to be offset with respect to the local relation. So the galaxy seems to be under luminous in C-plus with respect to what expected from local relation. So
these are different redshifts, no? Or, I mean,
Around six, five point six. Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
okay, yes. Roughly. It's between 5.7 and
seven.
Six and seven. The only one at seven is the one that I mentioned before. And these are two lensed galaxies. And this is an upper limit, essentially. So, I mean, even with lenses, you are a bit in trouble. And so we, in this plot, the other lines are a recent prediction from our work in 2015 and also the prediction from the group in Copenhagen, so the Olsen paper. But the fact is that Olsen focused on redshift 2. While we focus on redshift more close to the redshift of this object. And these are the two predictions that we have for two different values of metallicity. And I'll explain now how we got these two relations, which seems to work well, but...
Before, like, the Olsen paper, that's like roughly solar metallicity, right?
Yes, roughly solar metallicity, but I don't remember exactly, but I think that you have also something at 20% solar, mm-hmm. But I should check.
Yeah, so that would be comparable to the your line.
Yes, but they have a more massive galaxy. The galaxies are much more massive, and yes, in principle, I mean, at least the slope is going to the same.
Yeah.
Star formation rate is given by FIR?
No, for this object, no.
What is the star formation rate indicated?
The detection with Hubble, so the
UV plus slope, right? That is some dust correction.
Yes. They don't, I mean, the majority of the, of these objects are not detected in continuum with ALMA. So you don't know.
But what are the upper limits of the star formation rates? Like, are some objects?
I mean, yes, there are also uncertainties in this reaction. Yeah. Here are not, the error bars here are not plotted, but. Yes, but I mean, this not, I think, is not going to help a lot, because I think the only worry is to underestimate the star formation rate because of dust, maybe. So, I mean, I would say that.
Yeah, but some of them have upper limits, right? Some of them have an error limit.
The red point?
Yeah, there's a couple.
There's
a couple.
Yeah,
the green one.
No, so the green one is the detection at the periphery of BDF, so the one that I have shown before. So they cannot associate the clamp an actual star formation rate, because it's at the periphery, so they put the point here, but the star formation rate is only an estimate based on the fraction of the star formation rate of the galaxy. So this is, I mean, it's not measured, it's not detected in UV. In respect. So yes. So to get all this relation, we work on our model. We include another part in the model. So the emission also from the dense PDR around molecular clouds. So the location of the molecular clouds is highlighted here. Essentially, the cells in which the gas the mass of the gas exceed the genes mass are molecular for us. And we perform PDR calculation on top of that. And we describe the density field subgrid of this molecular cloud by using a log normal distribution of the density. So just because we don't have power to actually see the internal structure of molecular cloud, so we assume this prescription. And we calculate the emission from the PDRs, and also we implement a metallicity profile. Essentially, we play with the metallicity. We use the result from Andrea's work, which found a nice correlation between the overdensity of the gas and the metallicity. So we calculate the overdensity of each cell in our simulation, and we scale the metallicity assuming that, for instance, if we want a 5% solar average metallicity, we need to have this profile as a function of the radius. And I want to point out that the PDRs, so the molecular clouds, are at the center, so here, and so they are expected to be more metal-rich than the mean metallicity of the galaxy. And this can be a good point, because when you infer the metallicity from the C+, you need to know also which are the leading contributors to the C+. And if the location of the PDRs and so the molecular clouds are in over-dense regions, you expect them to be more and more metal-rich. And so, I mean, it's you are not probing the average value, but the high-density tail of the distribution, essentially.
But you showed an example of the C+ clump outside.
Yes. Yes, but we also implement another, I mean, we also take into account another aspect, so the effect of the increased CMB temperature. Because essentially, at redshift 6, you have also to think about that the CMB has a temperature around 20, and essentially it happens more or less the same things that happened to the 21 centimeter line. So especially in the cold neutral medium, there is a coupling essentially between the CMB and the spin temperature of the C+. So the recovered flux is only 20% of the one that you would have inferred without taking into account of this contribution. Why? For dense gas in PDRs around molecular clouds, this is not an issue. So at the end, this is something that it's really, really important, because especially a redshift higher than 6, all these clamps actually are fainter with respect to, the, to what we talked in before doing this calculation.
Can you say, well, this seems counterintuitive because you're saying that you actually see the cold stuff, but the warmer stuff is this. So I would have guessed that the diffuse gas was actually warmer and so less likely to approach the CMB in temperature. But you're saying that you lose 90, so you're saying that you lose 90% of the emission from diffuse gas due to approaching the CMB temperature.
Yes, I'll redshift the.
Does that mean that it's colder? So
that mean that is no. It's
that the spin temperature doesn't the same to the CMB temperature.
So the so the population of the two levels is coupled to. So it depends on density, temperature, so it's not so straightforward. I mean,
it's some thermal excitation in the diffuse gas, isn't it? The electron fraction for PDR is much higher, and that helps in decoupling it from the CMB. Well, for the neutral gas, the electron fraction is lower. For the fuel gas, the electron fraction is lower.
Okay, so by taking into account all of these, we end up, okay, this is essentially the same thing that we are discussing. These are different models, but this is without the CMB, the contribution of the diffuse, while we take into account of the CMB depression, let's say, so the coupling between the spin temperature and the CMB temperature, we end up with these values of the diffuse contribution to the total C plus emission.
So that means that your line is changing very quickly with redshift at high redshift.
Your line. I mean, this becomes important at redshift higher than 6.
But 6.
So at
six
5,
is even
5.
Completely different than 7 if you could get enough sources, right?
Well, I don't understand. So because what ends happening is that you have the both components, both the PDRs mm-hmm. and the diffuse medium. So as you go to high redshift, you only kill the diffuse medium.
But if the diffuse is contributing a substantial amount, you would see it, I mean, at 5, for example, you'd be able to see it much better than what it's
happening. We don't know if this is true, because it was true in the previous simulation where she didn't have this.
I see.
But now I put also the contribution.
Realized later that this could be important.
So that was,
yes, is this is I mean, an incremental paper with respect to the to the all the things that we calculate in 2013. And actually, this is the spectrum that we predict for two different values of star formation rates. And actually, we found that the PDR contribution, which is centered at zero velocity channel because the molecular clouds are at the center of the galaxy, is the leading contribution here. But I mean, here in the PDRs, the gas is dense and neutral. So at the end, it's a matter of density, which is higher with respect to the cold diffuse medium.
And so, sorry, I'm being dense.
No, it's
in the spirit.
So I would think that PDRs. I mean, so you're calling things that happen to have a molecular cloud in them PDRs. But I would think that would encompass some phase of cold neutral medium around it.
Yes.
How distinct are these really?
So the fact is that the cells in which we found molecular clouds, so the cells that are genes unstable, we don't have the resolution to see, okay, a fraction is actually a molecular cloud, the other one is a cold neutral medium.
But implicit in the clouding stuff should be some transition from atomic to molecular, right?
Yes, and this is performed with a PDR calculation. So we take the density and we run a PDR calculation, assuming the flux that is given by the star formation rate and the distribution of the stars. And we compute the structure of the PDR. So a fraction of the cell is neutral, essentially.
And would be CNM if you had simply not seen it in a PDR, right?
But CNM is diffuse.
It would be denser, right?
No.
Well, sure, but it's
because I have
it's
also,
neutral.
Yeah.
No, it's true, but this is associated with cells that are intrinsically, you know, not molecular, but certainly high density.
Right. So I understand the distinction that you are not, these you would say are not in pressure equilibrium. These are not part of the two-phase.
These are gravitational.
But if I just define things in terms of, you know, where do they sit in density temperature space, then it's not obvious that you wouldn't get CNM.
Well, the intra-clamp medium in the GNC is something like 200 parts per cubic centimeter, while the CNM is 50. So you may say that it could be.
I mean,
sure, it's great.
No, yes. I mean, it's not really a two. I mean, the two.
Well, I guess the question is which one, I mean, what's the density you use to divide this one up? I mean,
so
why are they distinct?
Right.
Because this part is obtained also assuming a density field typical of clamps within molecular clouds. So I have the tail.
How did you find the molecular clouds again in the simulations?
With the gene scroll.
Okay, and you don't.
And then I say, okay, the density within this cell is given by a log normal distribution, yeah. Let's say. I extract with a random sampling, so I populate and I compute the mass, and I mean, I conserve the mass of the cell, of course. And then I give all this pack to the PDR.
Yeah.
And the PDR computes the emission, but the density field is not only as smooth as 50 particles per cubic centimeter. Mm-hmm. It is whatever. I mean, it's related to the Mach number. I assume a Mach number, and okay, we can play also on this aspect.
It would be interesting though to see, for example, coloring by atomic versus molecular. You know, what the C plus, how much of the C plus comes from is coextant with atomic gas versus coextant with molecular gas.
Yes.
The distinction here now, is dynamical, but in some sense, right? But you could also distinguish chemically.
Yes.
Which I think is something that people are.
Yes. Now, actually, we are. I will briefly mention that we are going. We are going to model more in details the molecular clouds and the PDRs to take into account very well of the density structure of the clouds. And so we also aim to have prediction for the CO lines and things like that. So that we can relate the C plus with also molecular lines that are, I mean, unique probe of the molecular gas.
And just one final question on this slide. The line is asymmetric, it's just a viewing angle thing, right? If you had viewed from another direction, it would have been asymmetric.
Yes, I mean, in principle, with the simulation, if I compute from the various direction, I can get eight different spectra, yes. Just
six.
Yes, six. I don't know, eight, two more. Yes, six different, which was a line of sight. So yes, this is a true. And this is the last, slide. So we, by changing the star formation rate, we calculate, and by varying the metallicity with the profile that I was mentioning before, we calculate the C plus star formation rate relation. So these are the prediction for 5% solar. This is for solar metallicity. These are the non-detection, essentially. These are the Kappa galaxies, okay? And I want to mention that we found that the relation should be similar to the one of dwarf galaxies, a redshift zero, which, I mean, could make sense because, they are metal poor with high radiation fields. So, this can be, I mean, something that can be easily understood, but the fact is that there is another thing that we are going to investigate, and is the effect of the feedback of star formation on the structure of molecular clouds, and so on the emission of the PDRs. And this is an ongoing, this is the work that maybe I can discuss next Friday, so on the blackboard. These are the take-home message, essentially. So the fact that the CMB background is important, especially for the cold but not dense gas at high redshift. The emission from PDRs is the dominating contribution. With PDRs, for me, is high density neutral gas, essentially around molecular clouds. This is my definition. And the star formation rate, the deviation from the local star formation rate relation can be caused by extremely low metallicities, or, and this is something that we are on which we are working now, the feedback effect on the molecular clouds. So maybe if you photoevaporate the clouds very quickly, you depress the C plus emission, and I mean you don't have clouds anymore, and you don't have the emission of the C plus, and so you deviate from the local relation. And this is something that we may discuss in next week. So that's all.
Okay. You summarize your PBR modeling is a bunch of cloudy models with slabs and.
In the run of 2015, we used a UCL PBR code. Now we are shifting to cloudy, because we are running different models. A different column density, so integrating up to different column density with different metallicity, with different G naught at the.
Is it summation and plane parallel slabs?
Yes, for the moment, yes. We choose that plane parallel geometry. We can also play on this aspect. Yes.
In the log normal distribution that you put in the cells, so you can connect the width of that distribution with a Mach number or tubular.
Yes.
So what's roughly what you're assuming there?
For the 2015, we assume 10 for the Mach number.
Right.
Alma, you said 5 kilometers a second, but why don't they go at higher velocity resolution?
Because of sensitivity.
Yeah, I mean, you could observe almost an arbitrary resolution, but you're totally, and you just have to bend to some point.
Yes.
And you have the manageable signal.
Well, if the emission is coming from very dense
that's
pumps,
right.
Then you.
Yeah, then you should be observing with half a kilometer a second or whatever.
Yes, but the
there's
problem
some
is
number past which you get the thermal mod, but then you're.
you have to ask days.
Right, so what is that for the cold neutral media?
I mean,
that's a way to distinguish.
Yeah, it's fraction of a kilometer a second. But
yeah.
I think even CNN lightlets you would expect to be turbulent unless you could actually resolve
yes.
an individual object.
Yes.
So I think the answer to your question is that almost certainly, unless people are doing something weird, things are observed. The band here tends to be fairly high, so your velocity resolution tends to be pretty good. Mm-hmm. And all the data that you're seeing presumably sits in the archive at higher.
Yes, and then they degrade. I mean, they rebin to lower resolution because they want to get more signal.
So there's an under the hood thing here where the observatory pressures people to degrade their data upstream, which is stupid. And instead, what you would much rather say is observe it like this. Disk space is extremely cheap. But what you see is just a product of sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in principle, you can play with the data in the archive and do whatever you want.
Exactly.
We can try exactly. Yes. Okay.
Thank you very much.